I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Representative Adam Schiff did not mince words when he argued yesterday for the impeachment of President Trump, accusing him of trying to cheat the election.
If not remedied by his conviction in the Senate and removal from office, President Trump's abuse of his office and obstruction of Congress will permanently alter the balance of power among the branches of government, inviting future presidents to operate as if they are also beyond the reach of accountability, congressional oversight, and the law.
Schiff is the House manager who, along with six of his Democratic colleagues, had the floor on Wednesday to make their case in day two of the impeachment trial that lasted into the night. They have the floor today and tomorrow, followed by lawyers representing President Trump. Trump, who was in Davos, Switzerland, tweeted or retweeted more than 140 messages yesterday, attacking Schiff and the other prosecutors, apparently a record for the Twitter-loving president. We asked Anita Kumar to join us. She's Politico's White House correspondent and associate editor to catch us up on what happened yesterday in the Senate and what's ahead. And Anita Kumar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. Tuesday was all about rules and procedures. What was yesterday about?
Yesterday was really just the opening. The Democrats kind of saying what they're summarizing what their case will be. And you mentioned Adam Schiff. He did most of the talking yesterday for the Democrats. And he kind of laid it out that they're first going to explain the narrative of the case, of this Ukraine saga and exactly what happened. And then the second part of their case, they'll be talking about the constitutionality. So we started hearing after his sort of an opening statement, we started hearing more of the details and the evidence they say they have about Ukraine and about what the president did. I was a little bit struck by one thing because I didn't know what was going to happen. They had a lot of exhibits, if
they
you will.
Did.
They had a lot of things. They put up a lot, and I didn't realize they were going to do that. Part of me wonders if that's going to, you know, keep the senators awake. As you know, they have these really long days, and some of them, they can't drink coffee on the floor, so they're feeling a little bit tired. So, you know, they had a lot of that. They also had a lot of comments from the president, things that the president has said in the past. And I thought, you kind of saw some of the senators perk up when they heard those, just kind of paying attention to exactly what the president had said about what he did and what he wanted to do by his actions.
You know, I was wondering, too, whether, and there were a lot of videotapes, some of it from the president, some of it from the House hearing on impeachment, whether that was a kind of workaround the Democrats were trying to do, because there is this argument about having actual witnesses coming into the Senate to testify, whether this was their workaround to get the testimony without the people there in the flesh.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. It did sound like, or did look like anyway, appeared to be, this was the workaround. You know, they don't know that they're going to have any witnesses. They're not going to know that until next week. So they have to go through these 3 days without any of that. So, you know, so they it felt like they sort of were saying, well, here's, you know, so-and-so. And they did see a good number of witnesses come forward to the House hearings. So they were playing those. But, you know, at the same time that they were doing that, you heard, at least with Congressman Schiff, kind of urging the Senate, you know, it's up to you. It's your choice whether you want to have witnesses or not. So playing to that audience, saying it's, you know, reminding them that next week the full Senate is going to vote on whether they should hear from, you know, key witnesses, either those that the House heard from or witnesses that they didn't. So people like the former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, current acting chief of staff Mick Mulvaney or others. It's up to the Senate next week whether they'll hear from them. So I sort of felt they were doing two things. They were trying to put this information out there, but at the same time saying you can hear more. You're allowed to hear more if you would like to.
And Bolton said if subpoenaed, he would testify. Is that correct, Anita?
That's right. But the last few days or the last week or so, when the president's been asked about John Bolton, he says a variety of things, but one of the things he's consistently said without using these words is that he's hinting that he would say that that he would try to stop John Bolton from testifying through executive privilege. So he would say this person, this former high level aide of mine, knows my thinking, knows all sorts of, you know, things about the presidency and my thoughts on doing my job. And that would I don't want him to testify because it would reveal too much. And so what would happen if we got to that point? I believe the Democrats would push that and say, no, he should testify. And eventually it would probably go to court. And the question is, would that be decided fast enough or not for this trial?
I watched a lot of it on television yesterday, and the camera obviously stuck on whoever the speaker was at the time. But we're learning that some of the senators were not just nodding off, but some of them were not even in their seats. Now, my understanding, Anita, is that these are the rules that when there is an impeachment trial, and it hasn't happened very often in this country, the job of the senator is to sit there and listen to the testimony.
That's right. Politico has a whole team of reporters over there, and they were saying that people were getting up and leaving, and there were times that many people were not on the floor. You're right. I think that is the rule, but there's also no one there really to enforce it. Obviously, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, is presiding over the trial, and you would think that he or the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, would say something, but they really didn't. There was really nothing that was said, at least publicly. Maybe privately they were spoken to. But it does sound like, from what my colleagues are reporting over there, that there is, it's tough. It's a long, long day. They had a long day on Tuesday particularly. And so then they're back for this, sitting on the floor. And they're only taking breaks at certain times. So, the break times are when they're supposed to, get something to drink or use the restroom, but it's actually other times that they're getting up and leaving and no one's really saying anything.
It's hard for me to feel really sorry for a senator sitting who have to sit for 8 hours and listen to someone talk.
Yeah, right. I mean, you got to remember what the Chief Justice is doing. The reason this is starting
exactly
at 1 o'clock in the afternoon is that he's hearing arguments in other cases in front of the Supreme Court. So, if you will, he's doing his day job in the morning and then presiding over this trial in the afternoon and evening. So he has the longest of days, I think.
How much do you think, and then this may be asking you to get into the heads of some of the senators, but do you think, and much of what we heard yesterday is what was argued from some of the fact witnesses in the House hearing, which was back in 2019. How much do you think this was news to some of the senators that they did not know what it was that Schiff and others were talking about?
Well, I can tell you that we had a story today where we quoted several Republican senators anyway, who said, oh, I didn't hear anything that I didn't know before. I think they have, a lot of this, as you said, was what has come out in the House. Well, actually, it's two things. What they're hearing is both what was said in the House or what came out from the House hearings. But there's a second thing they're hearing. They're hearing new information that wasn't available to them when the House hearings were going on, but in the last 4 or 5 weeks has come out through public records requests, through various media organizations, or, Lev Parnas, who's one of the people that allegedly was, President Trump's way into Ukraine, someone who was sort of a go-between. He has turned over documents and given some interviews. So they're hearing what came out of the House hearings, and they're hearing new information from the last month. But if a senator was paying attention and reading and listening and all that to the news, they likely know most of it. They may not know all the details, but they likely know most of it.
Let me play another clip from Adam Schiff. And he began, I think he spoke for 2.5 hours, and then he had the closing remarks. And here he is actually referring to the U.S. Ambassador Maria Yovanovitch, who frankly had to flee Ukraine, feeling threatened by some of the allies of the president. In fact, she was told to get on a plane and get out of the country. And this was the message, I think, that Adam Schiff was trying to send to some of these reluctant Republicans.
This ambassador that was so ruthlessly smeared is now a hero for her courage. There is justice in that. But what will really vindicate that leap of faith that she took is if we show the same courage. They risked everything, their careers. And yes, I know what you're asked to decide may risk yours too. But if they could show the courage, so can we.
Anita, do you think that's a message that resonated with any Republicans?
I mean, it's a little bit unclear. I mean, judging from what the senators initially said, You know, after that first day, some of them, you know, said, oh, I haven't changed my mind or I haven't heard anything new. But that clip showed a little bit about what Congressman Schiff was doing yesterday. There was a lot of pushing them. You know, in the very beginning of his arguments, he talked about the founding fathers and basically said, you know, you don't have a duty. You have a duty to react, to respond if you see something. You know, there's a lot of people who say, why should they do anything? Why should the Senate act? You know, there's an election in 10 months and that sort of thing. But his point was they have a duty to act if they see that something is wrong. So he's really trying to push them, to persuade them that even though there's an election, even though, you know, they may want to just look the other way, that they have this constitutional duty to do something.
And it seems like there are four Republicans, Murkowski of Alaska, Collins of Maine, Romney of Utah, and Bennett of Colorado, who, you know, could be persuaded. I don't know. There's a lot of focus on them, Anita.
Right, definitely. Well, Collins, Romney, and Murkowski, the three you mentioned, they have all indicated that they might like to see witnesses, and that's really the big next step next week when the Senate votes. Will they vote for witnesses or not? The fourth, Bennett, I don't really know that he said anything. There's a couple others, really. Lamar Alexander, who is retiring, so he's not running again. He has kind of indicated he might like to see witnesses. And really, I think Democrats are looking at that as the first step. They're not really going to what's going to be the verdict yet. They're really looking at this big thing. Can we convince Republicans and you know, some of these Republicans to stand with the Democrats and insist that there should be witnesses? And that's really the question mark. I don't feel like in anyone I've talked to, even people close to the president or, you know, close to or in the White House, really have any sense of that yet. And that's partly because some of those senators you mentioned, now that the trial has started, they're not really saying what they think. They're going to wait. They're going to hear the White House. They're going to hear the House. Then they're going to hear the White House, and then they'll decide.
Anita Roms, out of time here. Is there anything else happening in Congress while this trial is going on?
There really isn't a lot. I mean, obviously, the House is not, you know, the rest of the House isn't engaged on this. But really, everything sort of, it feels like it's just standing still while we're waiting for this trial. You know, I mean, obviously, the president has his business. And he was just in Davos, Switzerland. He just came home. He's going to Miami today to give a speech. But it feels like we're all just kind of waiting to see what's going on.
Well, I appreciate you joining us once again on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
Sure. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Anita Kumar. She's Politico's White House correspondent and associate editor, telling us what happened yesterday in the Senate, the impeachment trial of President Trump, and what's ahead for today and into probably next week. Well, coming up, we'll be talking about why health care is so expensive in the United States, why an EpiPen runs about $800 in this country and $38 in the UK. We've got two economists who'll be joining us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoena, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world that accounts for almost 18% of the U.S. economy. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services reported that healthcare spending in 2018 was $3.6 trillion. That's about $11,000 per person. Well, what are we getting for all that money? A recent study by the Journal of the American Medical Association found that 20 to 25% of healthcare spending is wasteful. Our guests, economists Dean Baker and Jared Bernstein, wrote in the Washington Post this week that the extra medical costs we pay are really a tax. They wrote that if we applied policies used for things like manufactured goods and some price controls, competition, reduced reimbursements, and opened up tasks that only doctors are allowed to do to other trained healthcare professionals, we could save some real money. Well, since healthcare is driving so much of the presidential race this year, as in other years, we asked them to join our show. Jared Bernstein joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. He's a senior fellow for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, was chief economist and economic advisor for Vice President Joe Biden back in 2009 to 2011. And Jared Bernstein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back.
Also with us, as I said, Dean Baker, joining us by telephone, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a visiting professor at the University of Utah. He blogs at Beat the Press. And Dean Baker, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Jared, let me begin with you. I think of both you and Dean Baker as economists who look at housing and income inequality and labor markets and mobility and Social Security. Why healthcare? Why your interest in the cost of healthcare?
Because it's 17 or 18% of the U.S. economy in terms of our expenditures on health care. And, you know, that's more than twice the share of residential housing, for example. So it's incredibly important. And probably most notably, that share, 17-18% in the U.S. case, falls to about 10% if you look at other advanced economies. So we're squandering a massively huge 8% of GDP, you know, $1.5 trillion a year, something in the neighborhood, on waste. And this is unsustainable. As is often the case in our heavily money and politics economy, when something's unsustainable, its burden tends to fall on the most economically vulnerable.
Well, we have really many healthcare systems, Dean Baker. And we've got obviously the private healthcare system. You've got the VA, you've got Medicare, you've got Medicaid, you've got SNAP, Affordable Care Act, and probably others as well. Does that help explain both the cost, maybe even the wastefulness, even the inefficiencies?
Yeah, that's a big part of the picture. Let me just throw in one more number, kind of drive home the
sure.
point Jared was making. If we snapped our fingers and we paid as much as the average of other wealthy countries, that's in effect $4,000 more for every person in the country, whether we spend that on education, on housing, whatever else. That's a huge, huge amount of money. So we really have an enormous amount at stake. But, you know, getting to your question, yeah, I mean, the fact that we have so much complexity in our healthcare system, that is a big part of the cost. We spend way more on administration. This is what the Medicare for All people keep pointing out. We spend way more on administration of our health care system. Their estimate is as high as $800 billion. I mean, there's some room for contention there. Right. But we spend an enormous amount just on administering the system. And I'll just give you a quick story from my days when I was the co-director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You know, we have health insurance for our employees, our workers. And we changed, not by our choice, because different plans are being offered and we couldn't get the same plan. We had consultants that they took their salary from the insurer, but we had consultants to tell us, you know, which plans are better, which plans are worse. I mean, at the end of the day, we had to make the call and we had to pay our own resource person to look at that. But this is just enormous waste that if you look to other countries' systems, it's simply not there.
Well, let's talk about some of the specifics. I mentioned the EpiPen running something like $300 in the U.S., $38 in the U.K. Jared, taking some very specific things that we use in this country, what's the driver of these costs? Why do we pay so much more than our counterparts in Europe?
Right. This is the key question. First, it's because we fail to control costs the way every other advanced economy does. We do very little to control healthcare costs. They do a ton. But it's worse than that, and I this is one of the main emphasis of our piece. It's not just that we fail to control costs. We actively allow costs to become inflated. Now, why do we do that? Why do we allow our healthcare costs to be so much more expensive with, by the way, this is key, we haven't mentioned it yet, with actually worse health outcomes compared to these other countries, not better. And it's because every dollar of waste in our healthcare system is a much beloved dollar of income to one of the many people and systems with their hand in the cookie jar all along the healthcare delivery chain. Moreover, these cookie jar folks all have not only huge revenues from this inefficient and healthcare and expensive healthcare system, we have a very porous money and politics system. So they use their what economists call rents or excess profits. They use their excess profits from the system to cordon themselves off from political pressure to invoke a more rational system. Let me just add one other point. I think there's a deeper problem. Those are kind of the mechanics by which it works. Despite the fact that half of our healthcare spending in this country is through the government, Medicare, Medicaid, we still maintain this myth that healthcare is a market good like apples or T-shirts. However, if you show up at the supermarket hungry, they don't have to feed you. If you show up at the hospital injured, they have to treat you. So clearly this idea that healthcare is a free market good and should be treated as such is mythical, and yet the incentives to maintain that myth are hugely important for those with their hands in the cookie jar all along the healthcare delivery system.
Well, let me pick up on several things, and Dean, I'll toss this back to you. I'm curious about who all those people who have their hands in the cookie jar are, but I'm wondering whether this isn't then an argument for things like price controls. And I'm also thinking that Medicare, for instance, cannot negotiate for drug prices. There are millions of older Americans who need these pharmaceuticals, who get their health care through Medicare, and Medicare cannot negotiate.
Yeah, it goes actually even beyond price controls, because we already sort of have price controls, but in the opposite direction. The reason drugs are expensive is because we give the drug companies patent monopolies. Same thing with medical equipment, a kidney dialysis machine, an MRI machine. The reason all these things would be very cheap. No one would even be talking about paying for drugs if they're sold in the free market. Mm. So we aren't really arguing with people who want a free market here. What they want is patent monopolies. The government gives them a patent monopoly. They'll arrest anyone who competes with them and then tell us we can't negotiate like every other country does. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, frankly, the case with prescription drugs and, for that matter, medical equipment, I think it makes a lot of sense to pay for the research up front. We already do a lot of that through National Institutes of Health. We spend over $40 billion a year, and you add in CDC and other agencies, it might be as high as $50 billion. Hmm. Paid for the research up front, it all could be, you know, in the public domain. It could be shared by other researchers, and then they would be cheap. You know, we wouldn't have to worry about paying for drugs and medical equipment. And carrying Jared's point about why these aren't medical care isn't a normal good, it goes even a step further in the sense that when I get a iPhone or a computer or whatever, a car, I could read about it, have a pretty good idea of what I'm getting. And, of course, if I make the wrong choice, it's not really a disaster. I'll be pissed if I spend too much on my cell phone or whatever. But that's not a disaster. With health care, there's an incredible problem of asymmetric information. Even if we try to be good patients and read up online, this and that, we don't have the information. The drug companies have it. The medical equipment suppliers have it. So this is, again, a reason why it just doesn't make sense to talk about this as a normal market good. So I would argue, one, let's not make this stuff expensive. We don't have to labor over whether, oh, here's this person 80 years old and they need an expensive cancer drug. The drug's not expensive. It's cheap. If we might think that helps them, then give it to them. So one, pay for the research up front, get the price down. If we can't do that right away, and surely we can't do that right away, we should do what other countries do, negotiate drug prices and cut our prices in half, or in many cases, two-thirds, three-quarters. And then the other thing, yeah, we do need, you know, Jared and I talk about this, and we feel very strongly about it. We need universal coverage. The Affordable Care Act moved us closer, but we have a long way to go. And, of course, we know many of the people, even who have coverage, they still find themselves with medical bills that are completely unaffordable.
Jared, let me just pick up on something that Dean just said there. And this is the argument that comes from drug companies saying we need these patents because we're doing all this research. Now, I understand that the U.S. government also does that. But this is the argument from these drug companies saying that we can't make these specialized drugs unless we can have the kind of control over the prices that we want.
Well, they're not completely wrong in the sense that without the cost-exploding patents that Dean and I write about, it's certainly possible, probably likely, that the pharmaceuticals and the equipment companies would do less of the kind of speculative research they engage in now. But that doesn't mean we're at their mercy, because if it did, we'd be basically admitting, okay, we have to live with an inequitable, unjust, and unsustainable system. And the pressures, the opportunity costs that we've talked about truly are unsustainable. That's why the debate is so live, as you hear it in the debate.
Yep.
So we have to come up with an alternative method. We could take a fraction of savings from reducing the kinds of a fraction of the savings of the type Dean just mentioned from reducing the protectionism that we provide through patent-supported research and use that for publicly supported research. So the answer is that we would have to have the public sector engage in research the private sector now does. Now, that may sound radical and crazy. In fact, as Dean said, it is very much ongoing. The National Institute of Health is a premier top-shelf research agency, and it's publicly funded. So this is not at all an undoable or implausible path forward.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, the two of you. That's Jared Bernstein. He's Senior Fellow for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Dean Baker is Senior Economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And earlier this week, they had a piece in the Washington Post arguing that we have, yes, a very expensive healthcare system, and we're not getting our money's worth, and there are ways to reduce some of those costs. And again, you can join the conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Dean, let me just follow up with you. And I mean, obviously, with the presidential candidate, we've got on the trail, they're talking about Medicare for all, Medicare for some, a single payer system. I mean, if we could start from scratch, which we can't, would a single payer system be the system that would both deliver quality health care and also be affordable?
To my view, yes. I mean, you have another number of examples of single payer type systems. So in some cases, for example, in the case of the UK or Denmark, the government actually directly provides the care. So it's not just an insurance system. They're actually providing the care. Canada, of course, is what we often refer to since it's our neighbor, and they actually do call it Medicare. So it's the same name. But you do save an enormous amount of administrative costs. Now, just to be clear, none of these systems are perfect. So you mention one of these systems and someone goes, oh, I know so and so, and they had to wait 6 months, 2 years for, you know, an important surgery. That occasionally happens. That's not the typical story. People have done plenty of analyses, and our wait times for different procedures are pretty comparable to the UK, pretty comparable to Canada, pretty comparable to Denmark, these other countries. Now, again, I wouldn't get hung up on the single-payer system. I think I'd love to, again, you asked me if we were starting from scratch, would I do that? Yes. We certainly, at least in my view, I don't think we can get there overnight. And it is worth pointing out that you have other systems where they have well-regulated insurers, generally nonprofits like Germany, where they do provide good care at much lower cost. But I will say those tend to be more expensive because you still have duplicative activity. And, you know, basically the idea of competing insurers, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. I always get a kick out of this when people say, you know, we want choice. And sure, when I want to buy a car, I'm going to get a smartphone, I want choice. But I don't know anyone in their right mind who wants to be sitting there looking through insurance policies and go, oh, well, this one's better if I get cancer, but it's not as good on heart disease. I mean, that's close to nuts. So I don't really think that's the sort of choice people are looking for.
Let me get Dave. Hold on, Jared. Let me just get Dave from Maple Glen to join our conversation. And Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for doing this really important and really educational show.
You're welcome.
As you know, I wrote a book of Marketplace Medicine in 1992 predicting all these costs and horrors of our system that have all come true now. And what I wanted to say is this. If people always say that we don't want government-run health care, all these other democracies...
Are you there?
One fashion or another, yeah, that have public health care of one form or another, like NHS or in England or, you know, Canada's Medicaid, are all countries that have had more conservative governments than liberal or socialist governments in the times they've had this health care system, and yet they never get rid of it because any conservative government in these countries that got rid of their public government-run health care would be out on its ear right away. They're so popular. Well, and nobody ever talks about that.
Well, I'm glad you did. And thanks for calling into Radio Times. Jared, you want to speak to Dave's comment?
Yes, and then I want to say something about this healthcare debate in our country, yes. Which relates to Dave's comments. So Dave's exactly right. And I think this is a really interesting point. I think it comes down to the, again, I keep calling it the cookie jar, this idea that there are a large group of powerful vested interests who don't want healthcare to cost less because it would mean a huge cut to their income. And they have much more political sway in this country than they've had in other countries. What's happened, getting to what Dave was talking about, what's happened in some countries with center-right or more conservative governments is that they've been where we are in many cases, in the Netherlands and Germany, and they've looked at the unsustainability of their system. But because of their political orientation, they've said, well, we don't want to go to necessarily single-payer public delivery system like the Canada. The UK. We want to keep the private sector in place. That is a totally viable approach. We see it work well in the Netherlands, in Germany, in Switzerland. Again, for, you know, a half to two-thirds of what we're spending with better outcomes. But in every one of those systems, the private sector is far more regulated than it is here. Mm-hmm. They have something called global budgeting, where they sit down with the representatives of the private sector, the private insurers, and they say, here's what we're going to spend this year. Here's the rate at which costs can grow this year. Here's what you can charge for this and for that. That is, antithetical to what we're doing. And as you yourself pointed out earlier, even in Medicare, where the government is the single payer, we don't allow Medicare to use its massive leverage to lower health costs. So the system is the American system is just in the throttle hold of forces who are milking it for excess profits, where other countries just largely disallow that.
I'm going to pick up on a bunch of things that you said, but we do need to take a very short break. That's Jared Bernstein, again, senior fellow for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Also with us, Dean Baker, a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And we saw an article they wrote earlier this week in the Washington Post about why our healthcare system is so expensive. They have some ideas about how to rein in some of those costs. I'm sure you do as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Dean Baker and Jared Bernstein about why we pay so much for health care in this country, the most expensive compared to other advanced economies. And yet, in many ways, health outcomes aren't any better, and in many ways, they are even worse. Let me play a clip from a British show. It's called Politics Joe. The host went around Britain asking citizens what they think about health care costs in the United States.
So, two EpiPens. Okay. How much do you reckon they are?
$40.
I'm afraid not.
More?
More.
$100.
More.
$150.
More.
$250.
More.
Shut the fridge.
More.
£300. $600. Yeah. What? Why?
That's a very good question.
$600?
Yeah. Cost of childbirth.
$100? $200?
Dollars.
Yeah.
The average is about $10,000. It can go up to $30,000.
$10,000 for a baby.
Yeah, well, I guess. How much is your child worth?
Yeah. What, is that like the same everywhere?
Yeah, the average is about $10,000, yeah.
That's mad. Mm. Oh, no thanks. Mental.
I wonder if you could tell me how expensive you think calling an ambulance out to your location is in America.
I guess it depends on like where you live. It really does. Is there a price for that?
Yes.
Jeez, $100, $200?
$2,500.
For what? Why? Why?
Dean Baker, why? Why? The Brits ask.
Yeah, well, this is exactly what Jared was talking about, the rents in our system. And you know, a couple points here. First off, Jared was making the point about the popularity of these systems. UK just had their big election back in December. Brexit was a central issue, but Boris Johnson, who of course, the Conservative who won, is one of the most conservative prime ministers in God knows how long, and he's a big supporter, at least he said. He's going to increase funding for the National Health Care Service. So, you know, it just shows, you know, how much great support there is for that. But, you know, we have so many rent seekers, and, you know, the examples that were given there, the ambulance, that's actually one that I shouldn't say great story, it's a horrible story. Mm-hmm. But very often you have people who have good insurance, and they experience emergency and they need an ambulance. The ambulance isn't covered by their insurance or it's out of network, and they end up paying often thousands of dollars for ambulance. And we've had this issue, surprise medical billing. So again, this is the story. These are people who have good insurance, so they think they're covered, that they have, you know, relatively affordable deductible and co-pays and everything. And then they find they have bills of thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars, because someone, they could be getting an operation and the anesthesiologist or someone else performing a service while they're not unconscious. Turns out they weren't in network, something they have no control over, and it turns out now they have this huge bill. So this is an area of private equity, I should mention. My colleague Eileen Applebaum's done a lot of work on this, has been very big in. But it's like, this is incredibly, well, I'm reluctant to use the word, but I think it's appropriate. It's sleazy. I mean, we understand someone trying to make money by producing a better product, but this is trying to find a way, how can I slip myself into this system? I have an unconscious patient, consumer, and here I'm going to slip them with this huge bill, and there's nothing they can do about it because, you know, they weren't there to decide whether they wanted the service or not. They had no choice, and now they have to pay it.
Jared, let's talk about doctors, and let's also talk about patients and hospitals as well. Are you and Dean arguing that doctors should get paid less for the work that they do?
Yeah, I think pretty much everybody along the chain, especially at the high end of the system, will need to be paid less if we're going to achieve the kinds of savings that all these other countries we're talking about have achieved. I think it was in our piece, we quote the Nobel laureate Angus Deaton,
yeah,
and his wife, Princeton, Anne Case. Anne Case says, we can brag we have the most expensive health care. We now can also brag it delivers the worst health care of any rich country. One of the points that they're a married couple, that Case and Deaton make, is that if you look at the denizens, so the folks who are in the very top, you know, 1% or 0.1%, sounding like Bernie Sanders here, of the income scale, a high disproportionate share of them are doctors, and that's just not the case. I mean, it's being a physician is a good upper middle class, well upper middle class job in some of these other countries, but no, you're not going to see the kinds of salaries there that we have here. In fact, one of the things that Dean and I argue for, you mentioned this earlier, is allowing less high-paid professionals to do some tasks that are now cordoned off for doctors, but also relaxing some of the protectionism in terms of allowing people from other countries who have medical training that's equivalent to what we've had here to come here and compete with doctors. There's a kind of an anti-immigration, almost a xenophobia that very much predates the Donald Trump version, but it was very narrow to this upper end of the healthcare system.
But if you go to a hospital, you see a lot of people from foreign countries.
Yeah,
yeah,
roughly 25% of our doctors did have foreign medical training. About 5% of the total are U.S. citizens who got their training, say, in Grenada and, you know, elsewhere. So roughly 28% have foreign training and foreign-born. Of course, there are some foreign-born doctors who are trained here. But we have very restrictive rules on foreign doctors coming into the U.S. You have to complete a U.S. medical residency. So you could have been practicing in Germany, France, 10, 15 years, have a solid record, well-respected doctor there. If you want to practice in the U.S., you have to go through a whole new residency. And it's kind of striking. I mean, this is just straight out-and-out protectionism. And as an economist, I kind of have fun with a lot of proponents of free trade, which I generally think is a good idea. But yeah. you talk about a tariff, a 10% tariff on, you know, Trump's tariffs, or I'm not advocating as Trump tariffs, but, you know, you talk about those, oh, throw up their arms, horrible, stupid, this and that, and go, okay, what about restrictions on doctors? And then they look at you blank-faced and go, you know, there's a lot more money at stake with doctors. If we paid our doctors comparable to what they got in Germany and France, there'd be a lot more money, a lot larger savings than whatever we're arguing about with these other tariffs. But it gets almost no political attention, and I'll just say that's because of the power of doctors.
Yeah, go ahead, Jared.
I was going to say, so that's what a point I wanted to get back to earlier when you asked if we were starting from scratch, what would we do? Of course, we're not starting from scratch.
No, we're not.
And the system that we're describing and the stakeholders, like the doctors Dean was just talking about, obviously have a vested interest in the status quo. And by the way, to be very clear, there are many progressive healthcare professionals, including doctors, who are avid advocates of universal coverage and a system that would award them, that would reward them far less. So it's I don't want to be too sweeping in this point. But since we're starting from where we are, I've been an advocate of a more gradual approach to get to universal coverage. And I think the reason is because of all of these excess profit seekers along the way, they're just not going to go gently into that good night. So I'm more convinced of an incremental approach that adds a public option, some sort of Medicare or Medicaid option, including to employer-based plans, so that people can gradually reap the benefits of care that's more affordable. And I think that's kind of a political reality of getting from where we are to where we need to be.
Well, let me read a question from Adrian, and Dean, I'll put this to you. He says, I'm British and I've always been appalled at the American system. My question is, how do we get people weaned off believing that they have to get their health care from their employer? And millions of people do, including people that work here at WHYY. How do you wean people away from that system, Dean?
I think you do have to go the public option route to pick up on Jared's point that you have to create a good, workable public system. And a lot of us had hoped that the Affordable Care Act would do that. And, of course, I think the Affordable Care Act was a huge step forward. I mean, there's a tendency to disown that even among Democrats, but it did extend coverage and it helped control cost. And it did also, I know this personally because my wife does have a pre-existing condition, it makes a huge difference because it means that we could get insurance, not necessarily cheap insurance, but something that a middle-income person could afford. So it did a lot, but I think you have to go a step further. A lot of us had hoped that Obama would be able to include a public option in that system, and we could argue he didn't do it right, maybe it was never possible. I mean, that's history. I mean, that's, you know, a good thing for historians, political scientists to look at. I think it's really important to have a public option, have a good, you know, basically extend Medicare, let people buy into Medicare. It's a good system, it's an efficient system, and hopefully we can make it better. But, you know, that's a really good starting point. So if you have that as a good alternative to employer-based health insurance, I think we could build on that. And I think at the end of the day, again, partly from my experience as an employer, I didn't want to deal with my employees, my workers' health care.
I get
insurance.
It. I mean, totally.
You know, I like them all and everything, but I don't know what the best insurance plan is. I mean, right. We worked with them. We had a union. We tried to come up with the best plan, but we really had no place there.
And just to make the
just quickly, Jerry, because we got a bunch
quickly,
of people. Yep.
To make this explicit, what Dean is saying is, as an employer, one of your choices would be this public option.
Okay. A question from Bill, who said, I recently read that if you ask for an itemized bill after a hospital stay, the total always comes down because they eliminate things like $37 for a Band-Aid. He wants to know if that's true. Jared, do you think that's – do you either of you know the answer to that?
You know, I recently had an experience like this because I had a very serious procedure. By the way, I'm always nervous when I'm talking about the healthcare system that any of my doctors are listening to me. if they are, it's a different.
Well, you're
Jared
safe
Bernstein.
Here in Philadelphia, but yeah, go ahead.
I had that experience. And I don't know if that was unique to me or that's what happens to everybody, but I was unable to learn the full extent of the cost of the procedure. I did learn what I had to pay, and, you know, thankfully my insurance covered a great deal of it, but I think he's got a point.
Let me get Phil. It looks like Phil is calling us from New Jersey. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Phil.
Yes, I'm a physician, and of course I'm a boomer, And the best and brightest of my generation, which I represent, went into medicine. I represent the top 1% of education people in this country. And I am appalled by how healthcare works and doesn't work and the amount of waste we have and the amount of waste that I have to spend taking care of it. And is it a right or a privilege? I mean, that's our first question. Mm-hmm. And is it important to our economy or not? I mean, healthcare is very important, and we tend to forget that. And the insurance seems to cause problems with risk and reward, who wins, who loses. And we have a system that's unsustainable. So do we really want to fix it before it becomes a crisis? I mean, as a physician, we always try to look at the worst scenarios and try to prepare for them. But we're not prepared for what healthcare is doing. Yeah. And we have people now who pay for it and don't get the care. And they also take on a lot of risk, which they shouldn't, and they don't take care of themselves.
Phil, you raise a lot of really good points, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Dean, let me give you a chance to respond. And Phil, and I think other people who are working in the healthcare field are tearing their hair out because of the bureaucracy. They have to hire, if they're a doctor, they have to hire a lot of staff people just to run the paperwork and stay on top of all the forms that they have to fill out.
Yeah, you know, doctors, you know, Jared and I are both saying we probably have to pay our doctors less. Certainly, if you compare to Germany, France, other countries, our doctors get paid close to twice as much as the average for those other countries. So we have to get their pay down, and whether get them down 50% or not, whatever. You don't have to decide that today. But, you know, part of the story, you know, our doctors will point out, we have to deal with all this nonsense. And, again, just speaking of a personal story with my wife, but I'm sure many other people have had this experience, when a drug wasn't covered by her insurer for a particular condition, she had a doctor, and don't want to get him in trouble, but he put down a different condition so it would be covered. Now you just think, like, what sort of nonsense is that? I mean, that's the sort of, you know, just incredible nonsense waste that we get because of the sort of system we have. And, you know, again, dangerous to speak from personal experience, but I've been fortunate. I've been in good health, relatively few occasions I've had to deal with doctors and hospitals. But I would say close to half the time they've had mistakes on the billing. You know, I'm saying defining a mistake where at the end of the day they reversed it. But, you know, I'm an economist. I'm used to dealing with bureaucracies and forms and everything. But what a pain for people who have serious health conditions, and then they have to fight with their insurers that, oh, yes, this actually should be covered. And I'm sure many times things that properly should be covered don't end up being covered. So this really is a nightmare for the people who don't need it. I mean, when you most need your insurance and have to deal with these bills, that's when you're in bad health. And why throw something else at people?
Jared, we're almost out of time here, but both you and Dean are talking about the fact that we have a very inefficient system, but nonetheless, it's about, what, 17-18% of the economy. So is it a drag on the economy, or is it a driver of the economy? For instance, it employs a lot of people.
It's both a drag and a driver, but in the sense that Dean mentioned at the very beginning of our discussion, much more of a drag than a driver. It's not hard to employ a lot of people if you waste a lot of money. Now, inefficiency can create jobs, and so it is the truth. It is the case. I noticed this when I was working for the Obama administration in the Great Recession. We were hemorrhaging jobs every month, except for healthcare, which just ticked along. That was useful on one level, but in the broader sense, it's the opportunity cost. It's the fact that every household is spending thousands of dollars more than they should to receive a coverage that's inferior to that to coverage that's delivered less expensively elsewhere, and those resources could go to all these other things that we need to do to control the climate, to mitigate our inequality problem, to help people get the kinds of educational opportunities they want, to improve our infrastructure. So, sure, you can say we're getting something for that 18%, and there's lots of jobs. But you have to ask yourself, what could we be doing if we weren't so wasteful in this one inefficient sector?
Well, time will tell, I guess, whether we will solve this problem. It feels like kind of a deja vu all over again. Mm-hmm. Jared Bernstein, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior fellow for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities joined us from the NPR studios in Washington. Dean Baker, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
Having time. You're very welcome. And he's senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. And we'll post the article that they wrote in the Washington Post on our Facebook page so you can read it for yourself. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aarons, and Kelsey Henson. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.